Good morning. Thanks a lot to the organizer for inviting me to present this paper. It's a real pleasure to be here. So this is a joint work with Gianluca Benigno. So the question that we ask with this paper is whether insufficient aggregate demand, low aggregate demand, can generate a period of stagnation. Here by stagnation we mean a protracted episode of low growth and high unemployment. So this is a very old research question. It dates back at least to the Great Depression. But recently there has been a lot of interest in this kind of issue because of, on the one hand, the two decades long slump that has been affecting Japan since the early 90s, but also the slow recoveries from the 2008 financial crisis that have been taking place both in the US and in the euro area. So I will show you some data in a second, but just to summarize, I mean, all these episodes have very idiosyncratic elements, but they have also some commonalities, so they are all long-lasting liquidity traps, so long periods in which the economy has been close to the zero lower bound, the interest rate has been close to zero, characterized by high unemployment and by slowdowns in the growth rate of the economy. So let me start by showing you some data from Japan. Here is the policy rate of the Bank of Japan between 1980 and 2014. So here you can see a clear break in the series in the early 90s. So up to the early 90s, the interest rate is well above zero, it is positive. Then in the early 90s, there is a marked fall in stock and house prices. The Bank of Japan responds to that by lowering the interest rate. And then since then, for the last 20 years, the interest rate in Japan has been very close to zero. So Japan has been going through a very, very long-lasting liquidity trap. Turning to the unemployment rate, also here you see a break in the series right when the liquidity trap starts. So unemployment is very low up to the early 90s, then it rises when the liquidity trap starts, and it stays persistently high for Japanese standard since then. And then the third fact that we want to bring to the table concerns the behavior of labor productivity growth. So here is the growth rate of real GDP per hour worked, so a measure of labor productivity growth. You see the series is a bit noisier than the one that I just showed you, but also here you see a clear break. So productivity growth is very robust up to the start of the liquidity trap, and then it slows down when the liquidity trap starts. And also if you look at the growth rate of GDP, here is real GDP per capita, you see a very big break. So you see that when the liquidity trap starts, there is a big deviation from the pre-liquidity trap growth trend. If you think about the US and the euro area and you compare the period before the 2008 crisis to the period thereafter, you see a similar picture. So we all know that interest rates have been lower than before since 2008 and that the unemployment rate has been higher both in the US and the euro area. Perhaps a bit less known is the fact that also the growth rate of labor productivity has slowed down. Not as much as in Japan, but also in the US and the euro area if you compare the labor productivity growth in the 10 years before 2008 and in the 7 years thereafter, you see that there's been a slowdown. And if you look at real GDP per capita, also here you see that the 2008 crisis has marked a deviation from the pre-crisis trend. So this deviation is perhaps a bit less, more marked for the euro area, where really the growth rate of the economy has slowed down since the crisis, but it's also present in the US. So with this paper, what we want to do is to think jointly about the behavior of interest rates, so monetary policy, unemployment, and the growth rate of the economy. And to do that, we propose a new framework, a framework that we call the Keynesian growth framework. You will see in the end, this framework is very simple. We just take a standard endogenous growth model, and we augment it with some nominal rigidities to think about monetary policy. But you will see that this simple addition to a standard endogenous growth model give us a lot of insights. And this is because this framework embeds some elements typical of Keynesian analysis, so the possibility that unemployment might arise due to weak aggregate demand, with the insight of the endogenous growth literature that growth is driven by investment, by profit-maximizing firms. And once you think jointly about this Keynesian and growth element, there is a two-way interaction between aggregate demand and growth that really stands out, and it's really the interaction around which the model revolves. So you will see that in the model, a slowdown in the growth rate of the economy produces a fall in aggregate demand, and this is very intuitive. When there is a slowdown in growth, wealth in the economy falls, so households feel poorer, And this reduction in wealth generates a drop in aggregate demand. And I will show you that if the interest rate is close to the zero lower bound, this drop in aggregate demand will generate internal unemployment. But the model also suggests some reverse causality, going from low aggregate demand to weak growth. Because you will see that in this model, when aggregate demand is weak, firms will have little incentive to invest in innovation or in activities that increase their productive capacity to capture some profits, because when aggregate demand is weak, profits also tend to be low. And through this channel, a fall in aggregate demand will generate low growth. You see there is really a two-way interaction between these two elements. And in terms of results, I'll show you that this interaction between aggregate demand and growth is able to generate persisting periods of stagnation. So persistent slumps characterized by high unemployment and low growth and low interest rates. And even more strikingly, I will show you that the interaction between aggregate demand and growth is so strong so that this event can be generated just by pessimism. I will show you that the combination of a weak aggregate demand and low growth opens the door to multiple equilibria, so pessimistic expectation can plunge the economy into a period of stagnation. For instance, a manifestation of this equilibrium multiplicity is the fact that the model features two steady states. So the first one is probably the one that you're used to think about in the endogenous growth literature, and it's one in which the economy operates at full employment, growth is robust, and both the real interest rate and the nominal rate are high. And I will show you that in this model there is a second steady state, one in which the economy has chronic unemployment, growth is weak, and the zero lower bound on the interest rate binds. And we will think of this second steady state as a stagnation trap, or if you want, as a state of secular stagnation. And then toward the end of the talk, I will talk a little bit about policy, and there I think that the key result that we get is that countercyclical policies that finance investment by firms can be a useful tool to eliminate the bad equilibrium in the model. So we show you how a well-designed subsidy to investment can focus the economy on the good full employment equilibrium. So throughout the talk, first I will show you a baseline version of the model, so a simplified version of the model that is useful to build up some intuition about the key channels involved. I will show you the equilibria that in this model are present, and in particular we spend some time talking about this stagnation trap, these states of high unemployment and weak growth. Then I will show you that even if we relax some of the assumptions that we made for simplicity, the results are still there, so I will show you some extension to the baseline model. And then I will talk about which kind of policy intervention can drive out the economy out of the stagnation trap. So the model is just essentially a Gionen-Howitt 92 augmented with nominal wage rigidities and the zero lower bound. It's an infinite horizon closed economy. There are households, firms, and a central bank. We want to focus attention on the equilibrium multiplicity that is present in the model, and so throughout this presentation I will abstract completely from fundamental shock. I will just show you fluctuation driven by pessimism or beliefs. So the household side of the economy is super standard. There is a representative household which enjoys utility from consumption. It has a one-unit labor endowment and no disutility from working for simplicity. So this means that the household just supplies this unit of labor endowment to the labor market. But due to the presence of nominal wage rigidities that I will describe later on, it might be possible that the household might end up working less than its labor endowment, and that there will be some involuntary unemployment. Households own the firms. There are no financial friction between the household and the firm at all. The household have access to a nominal bond paying a nominal interest rate I. So this is the budget constraint of the household. You see on the left-hand side its expenditure. So the budget constraint is in terms of money, in terms of currency. So P is the price of the consumption good. Then B is the stock of bonds purchased by the household at time T, and I is the nominal interest rate that this bond pays. And this will also be the policy rate of the central bank, so the monetary policy instrument. And on the right-hand side, there is labor income, previous return from previous investment in bonds, and profits from the firm. Now, let me stress that in this model, since households are identical and there are no financial friction, we could allow the household to write any type of financial contract that they want. We could allow for complete markets, nothing will change. From the optimization of the household, we get a standard Euler equation, which is telling you that the demand for consumption today is increasing in future consumption and decreasing in the real interest rate. And here the real interest rate is just the nominal interest rate divided by expected inflation. So there pi is price inflation. The firm side of the economy is a little more complicated. So there are two sectors. First, there is a sector that produces the final consumption good. This is a competitive sector. Firms in this sector produce using labor and a continuum of measure one of intermediate inputs indexed by J. So here XJ denotes the quantity of intermediate input J used in production, and AJ denotes the quality. So a good with a higher A is a good of higher quality. The quality of this good will grow over time, as in the standard vertical innovation model, and this will be the source of growth in the economy. Solving the profit maximization of this firm, or using the zero profit condition, we get standard demands for labor and intermediate goods. Turning to the sector producing the intermediate goods, here in every sector J, there is a leader, which is a firm which is able to produce the best existing version of product J with quality AJ. And then there is a fringe of competitors. And this is a large number of firms which are able to produce the same product, but in a lower quality. And here gamma captures the distance in quality between the product produced by the leader and the one produced by the competitors. One unit of final good is needed to produce one unit of the intermediate input, regardless of quality. So all the firms in the intermediate sector have the same marginal cost, equal to the price of the final good. And then in this setting, it's very easy to show that it is optimal for the leader to charge a price which is a markup, a fixed markup over the marginal cost, and to capture all the market. So the leader will enjoy all the profits in the market for product J. And this is what these profits look like. So these profits depend on a constant, which is not very interesting. They are increasing in the quality of product J. And most importantly, they are increasing in the aggregate labor used in the production of the final good. And this is very important because it's capturing a market size or aggregate demand effect. So when aggregate demand for the final good is strong, then firms in the final sector use a large amount of labor in the production of the final good. Then also demand for intermediate input is high, and then profits in this intermediate sector are also high. So here it's very important. When aggregate demand is strong, profits in the intermediate sector are also high. Now, let me put together these two sectors. So here GDP is the difference between production and the amount used in the production of the intermediate goods. And then in equilibrium, this is just increasing in aggregate employment and in this variable A, which is an average of the quality of all the intermediate goods. So this captures labor productivity. And here growth will happen through increases in this index A, increases in labor productivity. So remember that the economy has, on aggregate, a one unit of labor. So if the labor used in the production of the final good is equal to one, then this means that the economy operates at full employment. Instead, if labor is smaller than one, then there is some unemployment and some negative output gap. And then the final good, the value added, can be used either for consumption, so we already talked about it, or it can be invested in research. So let me turn to that. So here we take the research sector, I would say, straight from Maggion and Howitt. I will just go very fast because you all know this model. I will just give you the key ideas behind it. So here the idea is that there is a large number of entrepreneurs that can make an investment to innovate upon existing products. And once an innovation occurs, the new product is gamma times better than the existing one. So gamma is the innovation step. In order to make an innovation, an entrepreneur needs to invest in the final good, some units of the final good. The innovation is a stochastic payoff, so an entrepreneur which invests ij units of the final good will discover a new product with probability mj. And this probability depends linearly on the investment and on a constant chi, which captures just the productivity of investment in research. And it depends inversely on the quality of the product on which the innovator is trying to innovate upon. And this is just to make to ensure that the economy has a balanced growth path. And intuitively, you can think of it as the fact that if a product is more complex, you need to make a larger innovation, a larger investment to innovate upon it. So in order to mimic the equilibrium that is typical of continuous time model, since here we are in discrete time, we will assume that the time period is small enough So that the probability that two or more entrepreneurs make an innovation in the same sector is negligible. And hence, the probability that a new version of Goodjay is discovered will be just the sum of the success probability of all the entrepreneurs targeting that specific product. Let me turn to the payoff of innovation. So a successful entrepreneur obtains a patent to produce the new version of the good that he discovered, and so becomes the new monopolist in the market for that good. And here it's how the value of a successful innovation looks like. So this value is made out of two components. So here we are assuming that when an innovation is made at time t, the leader, the innovator, will start producing at time t plus one. So the value of making an innovation is increasing in the profits that will be in the, in the J sector at time t plus one. And moreover, there is a possibility that nobody else next period makes an innovation in the same sector, and so that the entrepreneurs remain the monopolies in that sector. And so the second term here captures this continuation value. And you see here the profits are discounted using the household discount factor because we are assuming that entrepreneurs finance investment in innovation by issuing equity contracts to households. So what's really important here about this expression is that the reward, the value of making an innovation is increasing in future aggregate demand. So if entrepreneurs forecast that aggregate demand in the future will be strong, that employment in the future will be strong, then that's a good time to invest in innovation. Now, in the baseline model, we will make a simplified assumption. That is, we will assume that these rents for innovation last for a single period, after which the monopoly position is passed to another entrepreneur. This is just to simplify a bit the algebra. Later on, I will show you that the results do not depend at all on this assumption. Okay, and this is what the equilibrium in the market for innovation looks like. So there is free entry. So there is a fringe of entrepreneurs that can invest in innovation. This means that there cannot be positive profits in the innovation sector, so we can be in two situations. Here, the cost of making an innovation is exactly equal to the expected return, and in this case, we will have some positive investment in innovation. Or we also allow for the case that the profits from innovation are so weak that nobody will ever invest in innovation. And in this case, we will have zero investment in innovation. As it is standard, we focus on an asymmetric equilibrium in which the probability of making an innovation is the same in every sector. And then productivity growth is just given by the fraction of sector that innovate time the innovation step. Okay, let me turn to the nominal side of the model, which is the one perhaps to which you're less familiar. So typically, you know, in endogenous growth model, we assume that prices and wages are flexible and that the economy always operates at full employment. Here we deviate from this assumption. And instead, we consider an economy in which wages are sticky, which there is some nominal wage stickiness. So we start by showing you a version of the model that embeds the simplest possible form of nominal wage stickiness. So we start by assuming that wage inflation, nominal wage inflation, is just exogenous and constant. And later on, I will show you that the results are robust to a case in which wage inflation adjusts to unemployment and in which there is a wage Phillips curve. But it's very easy to start with this case of constant wage inflation to build up intuition. Then in this model, there is a link between prices and wages because the price of the final good will be just proportional to the marginal cost of the firms in the final good sector. So the price of the final good will be increasing in the nominal wage and decreasing in labor productivity. And this means that price inflation will also depend, right, on wage inflation. And this is important because the fact that wage inflation is sticky, that wages are sticky, means that also prices will be sticky. And hence, by adjusting the nominal interest rate, the central bank will be able to affect the real interest rate in the economy. Turning to monetary policy, here we, as in the most New Keynesian literature, we think about the central bank that operates with an interest rate rule. So we assume that the central bank sets the policy rate as a function of employment. And here the idea is that whenever the central bank sees unemployment rising, it lowers the interest rate in an attempt to sustain aggregate demand and hence employment. And later on, I will show you, though, that what happens when the central bank runs monetary policy optimally. Importantly, here monetary policy is constrained by the zero lower bound. So the interest rate cannot fall below zero. There is a lower bound on the policy rate of the central bank. And you can derive that by, for instance, adding money into the model. Then if money is present, nobody will purchase a bond which gives a negative nominal return, and hence this will generate a lower bound on the interest rate. Okay, so you see the model has many components. Let me show you how they aggregate, because then in the end we can describe the equilibrium with just three simple equations. So the first one is the Euler equation, which describes the behavior of household demand for consumption. Here the only modification that I did compared to the Euler equation that I showed you before is that I used normalized consumption. So I work with consumption divided by labor productivity, which is the quantity that will be constant in the steady state of the model. And here you see that demand for consumption today is increasing in productivity growth because of a wealth effect, right? When productivity growth is robust, then households forecast that they will be wealthy in the future, and then the demand for consumption today is high. And then you also see that consumption is decreasing in the real interest rate, that is the nominal interest rate divided by expected inflation. Now, it turns out, as I said a couple of slides ago, that inflation depends on productivity growth. In particular, here, whenever productivity growth is weak, inflation tends to rise because marginal costs of the firms are increasing. And hence, to have a global picture of the impact of productivity growth on demand for consumption, we have to take into account. So we have to take into account the dependence of inflation from productivity growth. And if we do that, we find that there is a second effect, essentially. So you see that now productivity growth is raised to the power of sigma minus 1. Sigma is the inverse of the intertemporal elasticity of substitution. The sigma component is the positive wealth effect that I talked about. The minus 1 captures the fact that whenever productivity growth falls, then inflation rises. This lowers the real interest rate for a nominal interest rate, and this boosts demand for consumption. But the second effect we think is not too important, and hence we focus on the case in which sigma is bigger than 1, which is the usual case that we think about in the monetary policy literature. And then in this case, we will have a positive relationship between productivity growth and demand for consumption. The second equation of the model is the policy rule of the central bank. So this is how monetary policy is set. And actually, it's useful to combine these two expressions, the Euler equation and the policy rule, to obtain an equation that describes the aggregate demand side of the economy, how the demand for consumption is determined. And I will talk about this more in a couple of slides. The second equation of the model is describes the supply side of the economy. It's what we call the growth equation, which describes the equilibrium in the market for innovation. And what this equation is telling you is just that if aggregate demand is stronger, if LT plus 1 is higher, then investment in innovation will be higher and there will be more growth. And then the first parenthesis is just for allow for the fact that we might have a case in which profits are so low that nobody will invest in innovation, and hence growth would be equal to 0, or gross growth would be equal to 1. And the third equation is just the market clearing condition that tells us that the final good can be used for consumption or for investment in research. And here we are exploiting the fact that productivity growth is increasing in investment in research. Now, given these three equations, we can define a rational expectation equilibrium as a process for employment, consumption, normalized consumption, and productivity growth that satisfy these three relationships. And from now on, I will show you that for given value of the parameter and given initial condition, there will be several paths of this variable that satisfy this equation. So this will be a model with equilibrium multiplicity. So let me start by describing the simplest. Yeah.
Can you say a bit more about the role of the nominal side of the model in generating the key insight, which is the two-way interaction between productivity, growth, and demand?
Yeah, we will get to that. Yeah. If you give me 10 minutes, you will see that clearly. Okay, let me start by showing you the simplest form of equilibrium that this model can generate. Let me show you non-stochastic steady state. So these are equilibria in which employment, productivity, growth, and consumption are all constant. So this equilibrium, the equation that describes our model simplify a lot, and actually we can use a graphical approach to determine the steady state of the model. So you see in this diagram there is steady state employment on the horizontal axis and steady state productivity growth on the vertical one. And here this aggregate demand and AD and GG curve describe all the combination of steady state employment and steady state growth that are consistent with the aggregate demand and growth equation. So starting from the growth equation, the blue line, you see that it's upward slope because higher employment means higher aggregate demand, so higher investment and higher growth. Then it has a kink down there which corresponds to the level of employment for which aggregate demand is too weak to elicit any investment in innovation, and then all this level of employment will be associated with zero growth. Also, the aggregate demand is kinked, but this kink is there because of the zero lower bound. So to the right of the kink, where the curve is upward sloped, we are looking at level of employment for which the interest rate is positive, so for which monetary policy is active. Why is the curve upward sloped there? The reason is very simple. So here, whenever the central bank sees employment increasing, it increases the interest rate, and by the Euler equation of the household, a higher interest rate has to be matched by faster productivity growth. This explains why, when monetary policy is active, the curve is upward sloped. Instead, the horizontal segment of the aggregate demand of this red line corresponds to value of employment for which the central bank would like to set a negative nominal rate, but it cannot because of the zero lower bound. And then in that case, you see that all this level of employment are associated with an interest rate of zero, and by the household Euler equation, they are associated with a single growth rate of the economy. That's why that part of the segment is horizontal. So here the interesting result is that these two curves cross twice. This means that the economy has two steady states. So it has a steady state in which the economy operates at full employment, so employment is equal to one, growth is robust, and the nominal interest rate is positive, because you see in the intersection up there, the AD curve intersects in this part where it is upward sloped. And this, I would say, it's a usual steady state to which the literature on endogenous growth and monetary policy is focused on. But aside from this steady state, there is a second one, in which there is chronic unemployment, so labor is smaller than one. Growth is weak in the sense that growth in the unemployment steady state is weaker than growth in the full employment steady state, and the central bank is constrained by the zero lower bound. So notice that in this model we don't have any endogenous state variable, there are no fundamental shocks. Then this means that expectation can just determine in which steady state the economy will lie. And the intuition, I think, is very clear. So suppose that agents forecast that growth will be robust from now to the infinite future. Then aggregate demand will be strong. Then even by setting a positive nominal rate, the central bank will guarantee that the economy operates at full employment. First, profits will be strong because there is high aggregate demand. There will be high investment in innovation, and this will validate household initial expectation of robust growth. Conversely, think about the case in which households turn pessimistic. They think that growth will be very weak from now to the infinite future. Then their aggregate demand will also be weak. Even if the central bank sets the interest rate to zero, it will not be able to sustain full employment, so there will be some unemployment. Firms' profits will be low because aggregate demand is weak. Hence, firms' investment in innovation will be low, and this will validate the initial pessimistic expectation of housing. So you see how pessimistic expectation can plunge the economy into a potentially permanent state of stagnation.
France, but I'm sure in other European countries, there is always the issue, should you have pure demand-side policies, or you will get to policies later, or supply-side. And so there are some people in France, for example, who believe that, you know, what we call structural reforms or supply-side policies are totally irrelevant to increase growth, and you should just have pure demand-side, you know. So is your model, so later on you will tell us that this
Absolutely.
Model can in fact shed new light on that debate.
Absolutely. So you will see that in this model there is a strong connection between the aggregate demand and supply side of the economy. And here supply side policy will have an impact both by increasing the growth rate of potential output, but also aggregate demand. So this model suggests that there is a strong interaction between supply side policy and aggregate demand policy. And I will talk about this toward the end of the talk. Yeah, that's a very good question. So actually, this is a result that might seem surprising to you, but it's not surprising for people who have studied the new Keynesian model. It turns out that the stable equilibrium here is the bad one. That is, if expectations deviate from the good equilibrium, the economy in perfect foresight will converge to the bad one. And this is actually driven by the fact that around the good equilibrium, the central bank is responding strongly to fluctuation in the economy. And this is very typical of this model with monetary policy. So essentially the idea is that by responding strongly to fluctuation, perhaps driven by expectation, the central bank ensures that the good equilibrium is locally determined, in the sense that if you are going to be bounded around that good equilibrium, if the economy, the monetary policy responds sufficiently strongly to fluctuation, you're always going to be there. And that's the reason why the literature on monetary policy focuses on central bank that reacts strongly to fluctuation. But then this means that if expectations diverge from that equilibrium, so agents start to forecast that they will not ever go back to that, then the economy will fall into the other one. So actually, the stable equilibrium is the bad one. And this is not too surprising in the literature on monetary policy. But I will show you a couple of examples of dynamic equilibria in a second. Before doing that, though, and going back to the previous question, I want to show you that both the zero lower bound and the endogenous growth are really key in generating these two steady states. So let me show you what happens if we remove the zero lower bound, if we assume that the central bank is unconstrained. Then in this case, the aggregate demand curve loses its horizontal portion, it just becomes an upward slope line, and you see that we are just with one intersection. And here the idea is that if there is no zero lower bound, so even if expectation turns pessimistic, the central bank will always be able to lower the interest rate enough so as to ensure that the economy operates at full employment. And actually, this is also what would happen if wages were fully flexible. If wages were fully flexible, prices would adjust so that the real interest rate for whatever level of aggregate demand would always be sufficiently low so as to guarantee that the economy operates at full employment. So we really need both the zero lower bound and wage stickiness or price stickiness. And then also I want to show you what happens if growth is exogenous. So if growth is exogenous, the growth equation becomes an horizontal line, and you see that also in this case, just one steady state remains. And this is because in our model, the fact that growth can fall and generate a big drop in wealth is key in generating equilibrium multiplicity. So here the drop in aggregate demand driven by pessimistic expectation really comes through a fall in expected growth. All right, so now I show you the two steady states. In reality, there are a number of possible equilibria in this model. For instance, it's possible that the economy will gradually converge to the bad steady state. For instance, this is an example of a path in which expectations turn pessimistic, so agents forecast that the economy will end up in the bad steady state, but convergence to that steady state takes place gradually over time. So growth gradually declines, unemployment rises, and the nominal interest rate falls. Also, here I described the equilibrium in which the economy ends up in a permanent state of stagnation. You might think that this is unrealistic, that it's more reasonable to think about cases in which stagnation is just temporary. And actually, it's very easy to design equilibria with this feature. So, for instance, here I reproduce a type of equilibrium which is very typical of the liquidity trap literature. Here it's a temporary liquidity trap in which agents start by being pessimistic, so the economy starts in a liquidity trap. But in every period, there is a constant probability that agents will turn optimistic and the economy will converge to the full employment steady state. And this is the expected dynamics for productivity growth, unemployment, and the interest rate that you get in this type of equilibrium. So the economy, as long as expectations are pessimistic, stays in a liquidity trap with low productivity growth and high unemployment. But since agents know that eventually the economy will go back to the full employment steady state, the expected path of productivity growth, unemployment, and nominal rate gradually converge to the good steady state. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say for the baseline model. So now let me show you a couple of extensions that relax. How much time do I have? Perfect. A couple of extensions that relax the baseline model. So first of all, in the baseline model, we assume that nominal wage inflation is just exogenous. In reality, you might think that wages will adjust if unemployment arises, and wages will start fall if unemployment arises. Now, I will not get into the details, but you can look at it in the paper. In the paper, we explore a case in which wages are downwardly rigid, and there is a wage Phillips curve, so a positive relationship between employment and inflation. And the bottom line is that the results really don't change. So you see that here the graph is a little more complicated, but the two steady states are still there. And also with this form of wage rigidity, we can think about what happens if we increase wage flexibility. And it turns out that here, if we increase wage flexibility, the aggregate demand curve rotates up, and this improves the bad equilibrium. So the model suggests that higher wage flexibility is beneficial. Yeah. Well, you know, well, here we are relaxing a little bit the rigidity on the wage. So here wages are still sticky, but there is some adjustment to unemployment. So when unemployment increases, wages fall. So here we always need some nominal wage rigidity, because if nominal wages were fully flexible, then monetary policy would have no impact on the economy. What I mean to show with this graph is that we don't need wages to be very rigid. Actually, we could have that wages could fall a lot in response to unemployment, and still we would have the two steady state. But we do need some wage stickiness to generate the bad equilibrium. You could also have bad equilibrium of temporary duration with temporary wage rigidity. So you might think that wages will become flexible in the long run. We could accommodate from that, but it's important that at least in the short run, wages are sticky. This is key. Okay, another aspect is that you will see if you read the paper, I did not go through that in detail, but in the baseline model, the real interest rate, even when the economy is at the zero lower bound, has to be positive, because we are in a representative agent economy with positive growth, so we cannot have a negative real rate. But it's very easy to add some financial friction. For instance, we do that in a fashion similar to the uninsurable employment risk model of Ayagari, and then you could accommodate a negative real interest rate in the bad equilibrium. And then also something that we do is that we do a small numerical analysis that will not really call a quantitative evaluation of the model. We just consider a version of the model with persistent monopoly rents, as it is typical in a model with vertical innovation. We put some number on it and we see what are the quantities implied by our model. Again, I don't have time to go into the details. You can find them in the paper. But in terms of the key result is that when we compare the full employment and unemployment steady state, we find that the difference in growth is not very big. It's just 0.13%. Instead, the difference in unemployment is more significant. So unemployment in the bad steady state is 5 percentage points higher than in the good steady state. And this is because for reasonable calibration, you need to move aggregate demand a lot to generate a substantial impact on growth. On the other hand, if you consider the welfare losses are very large. So the welfare losses associated with the unemployment steady state are equal to 11% permanent increase in consumption. But most interestingly, half of these welfare losses are due to the endogenous drop in growth. So even if this endogenous drop in growth doesn't seem too big, it has a big impact on welfare. And then we also find that temporary stagnation traps are characterized by sharper contraction. So typically, if the stagnation trap is of lower expected duration, it has a bigger impact on the economy. Okay, so turning to policy intervention, which perhaps is in the end the most interesting part of the model. So first of all, we explore what happens if monetary policy behaves optimally. And here we have a result which is, again, I would say, very typical of the literature on liquidity traps. So we find that if the central bank has full commitment, it can fully commit to its action today and in the future, then this kind of bad equilibria are not really a problem. Because the central bank essentially, so remember, to have a bad equilibrium here, the interest rate has to be equal to zero. But if the central bank commits to never set the interest rate equal to zero, then this kind of bad equilibrium will not be there. But this is, you know, the result that under commitment, liquidity trap are not an issue is very typical of other model of liquidity trap as well. The most interesting case is when the central bank behaves optimally, but it doesn't have commitment over its future action. That is, it can only promise something that it will make today, but not make any promise in the future. And here, just to summarize, what we find is that even if the central bank behaves optimally, under discretion, the multiple equilibria are still possible, and actually the model with optimal policy under discretion looks like the model with the interest rate rule that I just showed you. Just a case in which the central bank responds extremely strongly to fluctuation in employment. Now let me turn to another type of policy which is not subject to this commitment issue, which is subsidy to innovation. So here what we explore is a policy intervention through which the government subsidizes investment in innovation, financing it with lump sum taxes. Here the idea is that one of the issues in a stagnation trap is that growth is weak. So perhaps if the government can subsidize investment in innovation and enhance growth, it can solve the stagnation trap problem. Let me show you how the subsidy looks like in the graph. So here the solid blue line is the growth equation in the economy without subsidy. Instead, the dashed blue line is the growth equation when a subsidy is in place, when the government is actively subsidizing investment in innovation. Very intuitively, the subsidy makes the growth equation rotate up, the growth curve rotate up, because now for the same level of aggregate demand, for the same level of employment, entrepreneurs are getting the subsidy on top of the private profits that they will earn if they become monopolies, and this increases the value of making an innovation and their investment. So the subsidy boosts investment in innovation. And here you see that the curves rotate because we're assuming that the subsidy is counter-cyclical. So whenever there is higher unemployment, the government is giving a higher subsidy.
So in fact, what happens is that you do something that boosts growth, and because you boost growth, with the Euler equation, it boosts the fact that you know you will be higher growth, boosts consumption demand,
okay,
and therefore the market size goes up, and therefore you get out of the bad equilibrium. That's the idea, quoi.
Yeah.
So you get out of it by what you could call a supply-side policy.
So here, the interesting you see that if the subsidy is sufficiently strong, then the bad equilibrium is not possible. And this is because the subsidy not only, you know, has a good impact because it subsidizes the supply of the economy, it increases growth, but also because it increases aggregate demand. So if households know that the subsidy is in place, they know that growth will never be very low, so they always will think that their wealth will be relatively high, and so aggregate demand will always be strong. So here, the interesting point of this kind of policy is that a supply-side policy has a positive impact on the demand side of the economy. It stimulates not only potential output growth, but also aggregate demand. And that's why this kind of policy eliminates bad equilibrium. There is one point, though, we have to be careful, because one key message of the model is that this policy has to be sufficiently strong. So if the subsidy is not sufficiently strong, this is what will happen. So the growth equation will rotate up, the growth curve will rotate up, but still we will have the bad steady state. And so the model suggests that supply-side intervention can work, but they have to be sufficiently aggressive, sufficiently robust. Yeah. Yeah, that's what we are assuming. So here we are assuming a counter-cyclical subsidy that depends on the level of employment, and we are assuming that the subsidy is zero when the economy operates at full employment, and then it rises as there is more unemployment. You could think about a subsidy that is not contingent on unemployment, and then that subsidy will make the growth line shift up. So you would have, even with that subsidy, if it is sufficiently strong, eliminate the bad steady state, but you will increase growth in the good one. Here, instead, we are thinking about a subsidy that does not distort the good steady state. Okay, so I think I will conclude so that we will have some time for discussion. So in this paper, what we do is that we develop a Keynesian growth framework, which is, we think, a simple model useful to think about the interaction between monetary policy and endogenous growth. The model features multiple equilibria, for instance, two steady state, one of which is a stagnation trap. And the policy intervention that this policy suggests are policies that boost the growth rate of potential output, so for instance, by subsidizing investment. And in particular, the model suggests that we need aggressive policy to subsidize investment, and importantly, that these policies both sustain potential output growth, but also aggregate demand.